We'll discuss chapter 5 on page 88. The Clarity of Pure Devotion said, "Doer of all Krishna, you praise union through establishment in truth and renunciation, and again union through action. Of the two, tell me which one is definitely better." The respected Supreme Divinity said, "Union through establishment in truth and renunciation and union through action are both conducive to the highest good. But of the two, union through action is superior. O one of mighty arms, Arjuna, the one who maintains neither desires for nor desires against is free from conflict and is known as someone who is eternally established in truth and renunciation. His happiness lies in freedom from bondage. Only those without understanding declare the path of the enumeration of the principles to be different from the path of union, not the knowledgeable." That is, they make a distinction between Shankya philosophy and yoga philosophy. In truth, we remember we have seven philosophies, seven schools of philosophy, starting with the most gross, Charvaka. That's pure materialist philosophy. Everything that's in your mind was once in your senses. You can only think about something you can perceive, sensorily perceive. Everything, every thought has form. It has rup, ras, gandha, sparsh, sabda. Now, Charvaka, then comes Nyaya. Wait, says Nyaya. Think about epistemology. How do you know what you know? And we know not only through our senses, but we make inferences from what we see and what we perceive. So not only do we have our sensory knowledge, but we also have deductive logic, where we start with a major premise and a minor premise and a synthesis. A syllogism. We have inductive logic, where we start with the universal principle and we induce a general definition to apply to that universal principle. For example, wherever there's fire, there's smoke. There's smoke on the hill, therefore there must be fire. Inductive logic. Deductive logic is where you start with a major premise, and then it's a thesis, the antithesis, and the synthesis. All books have pages. This is a book of pages. No, wait a second. That won't work. Where there is fire, there is smoke. That was inductive. We want a deductive syllogism.
It's working backwards, isn't it?
Yes. Deductive is working forwards. Yes. Inductive is working backwards.
Pattern of one thing happening, another thing,
yes.
And then you realize that it must be that.
It must be. It's a consequence of the action. So we have sensory perception, deductive logic, inductive logic, testimony. For example, Srima says it's true. And we believe Srima. Therefore, her testimony is true to us. And the fifth is intuitive experience. How do you know when you have a headache? Did you ever see your head ache? You felt it. How did you know when you were in love? You never saw your love. You saw the beloved. So this is Nyaya philosophy. It says that's not enough to say that only what's in your senses is true. From Nyaya comes Vaisheshika. All you can see are atoms tumbling in this vortex of space. And from Vaisheshika philosophy, we come to Shankhya. Vaisheshika says that everything that we perceive, everything that we think about, is of a material nature. And all matter is comprised of atoms. So all that we're thinking about is the material world. Even when you think about your spiritual life, it has a form. And it has a picture. And it looks a certain way, and it feels a certain way. And all thought is material in nature. You can't think of the formless. And that's what Vaisheshika says. Shankhya says that the forms of thought proceed from the principles. And that is that you have 24 principles of prakriti, and you have an independent purush, that consciousness which perceives the principles of nature. And yoga comes and says, the purpose of life, the function of wisdom, is to unite your purusha and your prakriti. Yoga philosophy says the function of wisdom is to create a union between your purusha and your prakriti. Or realizing the unity all the time. Same thing, that's a semantical difference. They're always in union, yes, but how often do we discriminate? This is an activity for my body, and this is an activity for my soul. So yoga allows us to unite and have our hearts and our minds in the same place. Purushke ki bulbo? Purush nirguna, yes, he's without qualities. The Purush is without qualities. Yes, Prakriti is with qualities. So here in the text, they're saying, those without understanding declare the path of Shankhya, of the enumeration of the principles, to be different from the path of union or yoga, not the knowledgeable. So we know that we discriminate only in order to unite them, to understand who are the constituent elements of that union. Firmly established in either path, one attains the fruits of both. If you choose either path, discrimination, this is for my eternal soul, and this is for my transient body. Or the path of union, I am striving to create a union between the two. Either path gives the fruit of both. That position, realization, attained by the practitioners of the enumeration of principles is also reached by the practitioners of the path of union. So if you take the path of Shankhya or the path of yoga, you will find the same realization. Who sees that the path of the enumeration of the principles and the path of union are one and the same, he truly sees, he really understands.
The goal is the same. Seems that the paths are different.
No, because the seven steps of philosophy are stepping stones. They are the paths. They comprise one path. All seven steps. When you begin, you see. and you get an inspiration. So then you start thinking about that which inspires you, and you move from the first step of Charvaka into the second step of Nyaya, thinking about what it is that inspires you. The third step is Vaisheshika, and you put it in the context of what is your life in this world. And the fourth step is Shankhya, which says, this is for how I bring my senses inside. I control my organs of action. I control my senses. I look inside. I perceive the objects of sense inside. I become one with the elements of existence. And I move through thought, through subjective thought, objective thought, into all of thought. And then dissolve the ego into the being of Prakriti. This is Shankhya philosophy. When I dissolve that ego into Prakriti, I become my Purush and my Prakriti unite.
I can see where the goal is the same, but isn't he asking the difference between a renunciate and a householder?
No.
I was going to ask, no?
Could you just explain it?
He says one of action and one through establishing truth and renunciation.
Right. He's going
to
say
to both
at the same thing. Yes. Yes.
But the methodology is different.
No?
No.
No. The methodology is the same.
Even one goes in his cave and one goes out and does the world thing.
Well, he's going to ultimately bring them together towards the end and say that even if you go into your cave, you've got to be doing something. And you've got to do it with renunciation. And if you go into the world, you've got to do it with renunciation. Both of the paths, both without desire. Even we in the chapter last night, in chapter 4, we discussed the impossibility to refrain from action.
Mm-hmm. But why would you go out in the world and act anyway, not being established in union, if he didn't have some desire to act? He would have some desire to go out and work or go to the marketplace.
Yes.
That would be a desire. He wouldn't be doing it desirelessly.
Isn't there such a thing as the desireless desire to serve God?
Yes. The desire which is free from attachment.
Yeah, it needs to come.
But that's something that comes later. After union's established, he's going out and I got to go get some food for my wife and the kids. I have to engage in action. I'll go chop some wood. The desire is to get the food for the wife and the kids.
Now he is taking the selfishness out of the desire, and he's serving through God. He's serving God through the vehicle of providing for his wife and children. Freeing him. The renunciate in the cave is a praying for the welfare of the world. Just as Sri Ma goes out into the market to buy some groceries for her kids or to sew from some cloth for her children, she does so without a personal desire. There is no selfishness in her desire. And therefore, she is free in that desire, in that function.
I guess both of them, well, I guess it depends how you look at it, but both actions, whether in the cave or out in the marketplace, probably until union is achieved, there has to be some little bit of selfishness in it because, well, I want to meditate so I can achieve union with God. Or I want to go out and get food so my wife and the kids don't scream because they're hungry. And then I won't be able to get union with God. I mean, there's got to be a little selfishness in there.
এখানে বলছে যে নিষ্কামভাবে করতে বলেছে যে প্রত্যেকের ভিতরে তুমি ঈশ্বরকে দেখছো এবং সেবা করছো। যেন নাকি গৃহস্থ আর কি যেন সংসারী যারা এই উপদেশ দিয়ে বলছে যে এই উপদেশ দিয়ে বলছে যে প্রত্যেকের ভিতরে ঈশ্বর আছে ঈশ্বরের ওদেরকে সেবা করছে গৃহস্থ।
He is giving the suggestion that even for householders, God resides within everyone you're serving. So therefore, when you go out to serve, when you go out to perform your functions in the world, you're going out to serve God. And if you keep your attention focused on the service of God, then you're united with the principles and you have renunciation in action. Just as Janak the king maintained the kingdom on behalf of a higher authority.
I always get confused here because he's changing the names. Go back to one. He says, you praise union through establishment and truth and renunciation. Now, is that the path of enumeration of principles? And if so, why? Did they sound totally different? They don't equate here. And then it says, again, union through action. And then we have the path of union. Well, he speaks of union both times. And I just don't know which refers to which.
Okay, he's just, yes, he is, yes. The first verse, he's talking about sannyas and karma yoga.
Sannyas.
Yes.
No,
he's saying that a sannyasi is a karma yogi.
Truth and renunciation.
That's sannyas, yes.
Okay.
No, he's saying that the enumeration of the principles is a Sankhya.
So this is a third.
Well, no, he is equating sannyas with Sankhya Yoga.
Why?
Well, because according to his definition, he's saying that when you are united with the principles, when you have control the organs of action and control the organs of knowledge and move your attention inside, you are equal to a sannyasi. You are united in truth and renunciation.
Okay, so the principles are telling us the truth. I mean, and renunciation is basically
moving your attention inside, focusing away from selfish interest. That I am the doer.
Now,
then he says that karma yogi is the superior path. Union through action is superior. Because if you can renounce your attachment to the action while you're performing the action, everyone must act so long as they have a body. If we can free ourselves from that attachment during the performance of that action, this is a superior path. He is Krishna, Kri, the doer of all.
Isn't that the end result of being free from the action?
It is from our perspective of striving to attain a result.
Yes.
But it is not from his perception of what is this universe. And that is the difference between the Gita and the Chandi. That is a major difference, because all through the Gita, Krishna is going to say, be established in the end result. Free yourself from attachment. Mm-hmm. Renounce the fruits of your labor. Chandi is going to tell us step by step, this is how you do it. Cut down your doubts, understanding. Want of resolution. He's going to say, Chandi is going to cut down the obstacles to attaining that sense of renunciation.
So both of these are paths of renunciation. I mean, he says it in truth and renunciation, but union through action means renunciation of...
Every time we have the word yoga, we have a state of perfection, a state of perfection of renunciation, whether it be karma yoga or shankhya yoga or sannyas. These terms all become synonymous when you put the term yoga there.
So,
yoga means union.
Yeah.
Union through action, union with wisdom. Union can only come about when we renounce our selfishness.
Then where he says the path of enumeration of principles and the path of union are one and the same because they both involve renunciation.
That's correct. That's the point. And that's just what the text is telling us.
But I don't understand what the first truth in renunciation. I mean, this is the kind of renunciation you could do in a cave, I mean, versus performing action.
He is distinguishing between the renunciation of someone who ostensibly has no possession or no attachment, as compared with the renunciation who has many children and a big house. So he's distinguishing between them, and he's saying that the renunciation is the same.
No, I think the part of the question for people that doubt is that until you reach that high state of union, people think that they can't do real karma yoga. I think it's a gradual process. It's not some instantaneous that once you go into union, automatically you can do the best karma.
Very good. Very astute observation. And you'll find that, you know, as we're growing in our capacity, our understanding of the difference between a job and seva and karma yoga is really clearly defined. A job is something that I do hoping to get something in return. And seva is something I do because I want to demonstrate my love. But karma yoga is something that I do and I'm not there. I'm totally liberated through the action.
Totally liberated before the action.
Or in the action, at least.
In the action.
In
the action.
Karma yoga is something that you do once you can do once you get to union, right?
No, not necessarily.
No.
I hope not.
Yahoo!
That means I got to go to the cave first before I can do my
room. No, karma yoga is any action that puts me into union. And we've defined them as Siddhanta Chara. Puja, Pat, Homa, Sangeet, Nrit, dancing, Pravachan. We get so into the explanation we forget that we're there. And Arpan, serving in any way that I feel it's a total bliss to share. Now that's Karma Yoga.
এখানে কৃষ্ণ বলেছে কি সুন্দর অপূর্ব কথা বলেছে যে কর্ম তুমি যদি জানো তোমার কর্ম কি তখন তুমি মুক্ত.
If you know what is your karma, then you are liberated.
I'm always having a good laugh. Really, once you're liberated, you're just a yogi. You're a jnani, you're a bhakti, you're all of them. How can you?
That's true. Yeah. That's the point. The path of Shankhya is the same as the path of yoga.
So
once you're in union, there is no distinction between the paths. You are in union.
Right. But I don't see how you can be a karma yogi and not be in union.
You cannot. You cannot be a yogi without being in union.
Right.
A yogi is
karma yoga.
Because yes, we focus on the action. We focus on the path. See, so many of us are so busy looking at the objective, at the goal, and we think of the path as something that we have to get over in order to get to the goal. So we're always dissatisfied with the action that we're performing. Whereas a karma yogi will say, wow, what a joy to be on this path. And they focus right on the path. They know where the goal is so that they know what direction the path should take. But their focus is on the path. So now the path is no longer an obstacle to be overcome in order to get to the goal, which is desirable. The path and the goal are one and the same. That's where you're in union. You get so focused into what you're doing. It's a delight. And sometimes you You get so focused into what you're doing, you forget about the passage of time or the fact that you are doing it. And it becomes karma yoga.
So even your job could be considered karma yoga.
If you forget about the incentives that they're giving you and the reward you're going to get for it, and get right into the job so much that you forget about how much they're going to give you for teaching this class, and what you're going to get at the end because you've taught the class. You just get into the class, and it becomes karma yoga.
So isn't all seva karma yoga?
No.
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 You're doing selflessly.
Yes, but I'm there. I'm the doer. In seva, I want to give this to you.
Yeah.
I'm there. And in karma yoga, I'm in union. There is no you, there is no me. There's just the love of God being demonstrated. So seva is savikalpa, with an idea. There's a separation, there's a difference, a distinction between the offeror and the offeree. Karma yoga, there's a union. There's no distinction.
Then how can any action be performed in duality? That's be considered karma yoga.
The duality is gone as well.
There's going to be that distinction of in duality of I. How can your action be?
Well, so long as there's the distinction of I, then you can aspire to do seva and demonstrate the love in your heart. Sometimes you get so much into an action that you cease to be the actor. And that's what we're talking about as yoga. Karma yoga means the actions through which I cease to be separate. Seva? No. Well, you can, but that's not the highest meaning of the text. The highest meaning of the text is we will perform seva until we arrive at karma yoga. Seva is the path to karma yoga. Do seva. Until you become a karma yogi.
So, Swami?
Yes.
For instance, the other night, I did that newsletter.
Yes.
And I got lost in it.
Yes, you did.
And then I found out 4 hours later that it was 2 o'clock in the morning.
Absolutely.
And
your seva took you to karma yoga.
Think so?
Oh, no question.
Why?
Because you forgot about the time. You forgot about you being the doer. You got so much into the action that your seva took you to karma yoga. You went into samadhi. You got so deeply into your love. Now that's karma yoga. I know, but what happens after that?
I take a nice walk.
You swingers are all alike.
So just because you forget about yourself,
yes,
means it becomes karma.
Yes. Just because you forget. Now, how long can you forget about yourself? For one swing or for 4 hours? And then you'll find which action is real seva and which action is a transient delight. When we see the movie and identify with the character and we get so into the character that we forget about our own selves, we move into yoga. But how long do we stay there? if it's really a good movie.
That's a good movie.
But more often we come right out, and it doesn't make an impact or a change in our lives. However, when you write the newsletter, you come out with something tangible that says, gee, I really felt good. And here's what I produced from that good feeling. And I'm going to share that good feeling with all the other people.
Will there always be that stage of coming back to the I?
There will always be that stage. Brahma sits for 10,000 years. Vishnu sits for 50,000 years. And Shiva sits for 100,000 years. And then, you know what? They come back. That's what we're doing here. We've all come back to this paradigm of reality. And now we're going back again to our rightful place, the place of understanding what is yoga. Chitta vritti nirodh iti yoga. The cessation, prohibition of all modifications or fluctuations in consciousness is called yoga. Union is defined as the cessation of all modifications of consciousness. I am not there. There's total absorption. Whenever we use the term yoga, we're talking about the state of the perfection of union. Absolutely not. I agree with you 100%. The only reason that we speak of them as being different is so that we can intellectually dissect and understand what the one path consists of. These are constituent elements, dhyan, gyan, bhakti, and karma. The path of meditation, the path of wisdom, the path of devotion, and the path of action are the four constituent elements of the path of life. They are not separate paths in and of themselves. Dhyan means focusing your attention. Without paying attention, how can we come to union? Karma means performing action. Without action, how can we focus our attention? Bhakti means devotion and dedication. Without being devoted to a subject, how can you perform action or how can you focus your attention on it? And gyan means knowledge or wisdom. Without knowledge or wisdom, how can you know what to focus on or how to perform the action? These are four aspects of one holistic path of spirituality. They're spoken of as separate paths of union so that we can have an intellectual understanding what are the constituent elements of holistic spirituality.
So let's say I'm doing Seda. I forget myself.
Yes.
Now, I haven't gone beyond. But at that time, I've forgotten myself. I'm doing the action.
Yes.
I'm still perceiving whatever. But now this is now karma yoga.
No.
I'm not a yogi, but I'm karma yoga. I'm getting
there. We speak of it as karma yoga because of the preponderance of the manifestation of your activity. Mm-hmm. However, you're paying attention to what you're doing, otherwise you wouldn't have lost your concept of self. Mm-hmm. So dhyan yoga is present as well. You are in a state of focused attention. You have devotion to whatever you're doing, otherwise you couldn't have paid that much attention. So bhakti yoga is present as well. You know what you're doing and it's working step by step. You have a system to your action, and that's why it's going so efficiently that you don't have to think about it, and so that knowledge is present as well. However, we're talking about the outward manifestation that we see and say, that person is now performing karma yoga from my point of view. Mm-hmm. However, in yoga, all four are present equally. only we speak of it in one term or another term. Right now, you look at our bodies, they're totally lazy. Our bodies are in tamoguna. We're not doing anything. Look at our minds, they're very active. Our minds are in rajaguna. They're totally active. They're contemplating. What is the essence of this truth? Is it true? Look at the substance of our thought. It's all directed towards union with God. Our thoughts are in sattaguna. Satta, raja, and tamaguna are only a way of looking at things. It's a way for us to try to describe from our point of view what appears to be going on. It doesn't summarize the essence of the total situation by any means. It's impossible. All three are present all the time. It's just a question where we focus our attention. The same is true with dhyan, gyan, bhakti, and karma. In order to be in any kind of union, all four must be present. Now we're studying each of them individually so that we know collectively what does it mean to be in union. This is holistic spirituality. We're not taking the path of bhakti, and we're not taking the path of gyan. We're not becoming karma yogis. We are going to become yogis, people of union. And that's a very significant difference, a distinction in our teaching that we're trying to share, is holistic spirituality. We're not dissecting the spiritual path and saying, well, she's a bhakta and she's a gyani. And he does karma yoga and he does gyani yoga and he does dhyana yoga. And now we have a new yoga, Srima Yoga trademarked. What meditation does not seek to transcend? How can you have transcendental meditation trademarked? What yoga doesn't seek to raise the kundalini? How can you have kundalini yoga trademarked? What path of yoga doesn't seek to attain the highest attainment of perfection? How can you have Siddha Yoga trademarked?
This is a new age.
The path is holistic spirituality. We're calling it life. It's not just narrowing in on one form of activity and saying, that's my path. No, everything we're doing in life is our spiritual path. Everything. So, should we continue? Please.
Man, that's a pretty good book.
Well, wait.
Spiritual activities. But when the whole, and I can see how forgetting about the self while you're in activity could be a yoga. But when you're meditating, and it seems a different type of forgetting about yourself and a different level of activity, it seems to be almost no activity. Whereas doing the newsletter, you know, your hands are moving, typing, whatever, it's activity. But sitting and going inside deep seems to be less activity and a deeper type of transcending. What do you think?
As we proceed through the different types of behavior that spiritual seekers pursue, we'll find that the distinction between them becomes less and less and less. Remember, we begin with Vaishnava Achar, the behavior of inspiration. Shaiva Achar, the behavior of, Vedic Achar, the behavior of learning about that which inspires us. Shaiva Achar, the behavior of practicing what we learned about our inspiration. Bama Achar. The behavior, the beloved path, the behavior of implementing all of the practices that we've learned from our inspiration. Put it to work in our lives. Make every action a demonstration of our spiritual knowledge. Dakshinachar, the behavior, the perfected, preferred behavior, reduce the necessities to act in the world. Siddhantachar, the behavior of scriptures. When you've stopped all the worldly stuff, you've got to behave anyway. Now what are you going to do? You're going to do what it says to do in the scriptures. Puja, Pat, Homa, Sangeet, Narit, Pravachan, and Arpana. Siddhantachar. We're going to spend our lives in worship. Yogachar means we come into union through this behavior. And Kulachar, the behavior of excellence. We're going to, whether we're sitting in union or acting, we maintain the same bhava, the same presence. These are the eight steps of behavior.
Now, Siddhananda bolche jokhon amra meditation korchi tokhon kono action thake na.
Yes.
Bolche amra srishti sthiti loyer moddhe bash korchi.
We are residing within creation, preservation and transformation.
So jokhon meditation korche tokhon kishe kakho kothay jacche tokhon mone ache ki
sabdhan. Continue. We are continually in the cycle of creation, preservation, and transformation. How long will you stay without activity?
As long as my body will allow.
Okay, and then you'll come back into activity. Now, when you come back into activity, there are two choices. You can do it for me, or you can do it for thee. Those are the two choices. You are compelled to act by the nature of the body. So you can act for your selfish interest or you can act for a universal divinity. Those are the two choices.
So I guess it's just choosing, you can choose to how you want to act.
Yes.
I can go to work at Trader Joe's because I'll make money to go on the tour.
Yes.
Not because I want to buy new cars, right?
That's right.
So it's a difference in your focus.
And motivation.
Yeah.
Yes.
So with that, there's one other aspect. I can go to work at Trader Joe's, while I'm working at Trader Joe's, I'm changing mantras, and I'm putting my mind always in God. No, but you can always have your attention with God.
Yes. And I can also serve every customer there with the greatest love and generosity and gentility and just say, hi, what a privilege it is to have you in our store. And yet, especially when you hand them the bottle of vodka.
Somebody lying. Somebody loves that vodka.
Well, I'm going to have to see your husband after the class. All right, well, let's move on to verse number 7. United in union with a purified soul, master of his soul, he has control of his senses. Recognizing his soul as the soul of all existence, even performing action, he remains unattached. The man of union who knows the principles thinks, I am doing nothing, or I am not the doer. even while seeing, hearing, moving, touching, smelling, eating, drinking, moving, sleeping, breathing, speaking, attending the calls of nature, grasping, opening and closing the eyes, he contemplates that the senses are moving among the objects of sense. He who performs all actions as an offering to Supreme Divinity, renouncing all attachment, remains free from sin as water does not remain upon the lotus leaf. Men of union, renouncing all attachment, perform all action with a pure soul. Only body, mind, intellect, and organs of knowledge and action work free from the feeling of mind. It's amazing. I feel like the Bhagavad Gita is a commentary on the discourse that we've just completed. Renouncing the fruits of action, the man of union attains peace, not the man of desires. He who is not in union, motivated by selfish desires, becomes bound by attachment to results. He who is self-controlled rests in comfort, renouncing the contemplations of all actions. The wearer of the body, who dwells in the city of nine gates, neither acts nor causes others to act. Remember, 2, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9 gates. The wearer of the body who dwells in the city of nine gates. He neither acts nor causes others to act. The Lord creates neither the actors nor the actions, nor even union with the fruits of actions. Rather, the essential nature of individual beings evolves according to its nature. These aren't God-given. This is karma. God doesn't say that mandate action. Our nature mandates action. The omnipresent Lord does not accept the sins of anyone, nor their acts of excellence. Wisdom and ignorance continually revolve around each other. Therefore, living beings become foolish. Here again, we have a clear indication that it's not done once and completed. Wisdom and ignorance continually revolve around each other. Even the highest attained being sometimes acts like a fool. But for those souls whose ignorance has been destroyed by wisdom. Why, you are laughing. Don't you see that?
No.
But for those souls whose ignorance has been destroyed by wisdom, their wisdom illuminates the supreme like the radiance of the light of the sun. Those for whom the intellect contemplates only that, as in tat tvam asti. The soul is absorbed in that, as in tat tvam asti. Bear loyalty only to that, as in tat tvam asti. Have that as their ultimate goal, as in tat tvam asti. They go and again do not return. Wisdom has made them void of defects. As in tat tvam asi. For so long as we remain in tat tvam asi, that thou art, wisdom has made them devoid of defects.
So how they engage in action would be foolish.
The sun comes very brightly and causes the water to evaporate. And when the water evaporates, it rises and forms a cloud. And the cloud comes and covers the sun. and then you can't see the light. That's the story of Indra and Vritra. It's a natural transformation of the elements. The heat of the sun causes the water to evaporate, and the evaporated water forms into a cloud, and then it covers the sun. So then ignorance comes and obscures the wisdom. No. Ignorance doesn't...
No, that analogy doesn't work for me.
Well, that's because you never had ignorance.
I've got plenty of ignorance.
Well, that's how it happened.
But how does the wise, how can the cloud, how can the wise be covered over by a cloud? How can the wise revert to ignorance or to foolishness once they become wise?
Because they can become separated from their wisdom in a moment of egotism.
Yeah.
Yes, everyone can. From Brahma to a blade of grass. Well, when Shiva saw Mohini, he forgot all about Parvati standing right next to him. He became separated from his wisdom. When Brahma saw Saraswati, he forgot all about his mandate to create a new creation, and he ran after his own daughter. He forgot his wisdom. If it can happen to Brahma, to Vishnu, and to Shiva, it should certainly happen to you and me. It could happen to all of us, or any of us at any time.
In the David Bhagavatam, every chapter I read, 20 or 30 chapters, the preaching in every chapter would call for either Mother Ganga or a celestial prostitute. And so, obviously, it can happen.
Obviously, it can. Yeah. And now we need, amongst the various qualities, we need to be patient and forgiving. To be patient with ourselves and forgive ourselves as well as others. Because we know how subtle is that force of Maya that can attract even the most wise being into forgetfulness. So then wisdom makes them devoid of defects for the time that they remain in wisdom. Please.
Then they go again and do not return.
Mm-hmm. That is their ultimate goal, and they go and again do not return.
That means they don't have to be reborn.
They don't. We already discussed that. We don't die, so how can we be reborn? Well, or you get to come back to the earth, as is your choice.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But those who have not achieved that, don't they have to come back to the earth?
Yes, they do. It's not their choice.
Mm-hmm.
Please, Micah.
Would the person who had the wisdom, wouldn't the wisdom get stronger and stronger even if there was an egotistic, like an action performed egotistically, wouldn't it strengthen the wisdom?
Absolutely. And the wisdom grows and grows and grows, and the force of Maya becomes less and less and less enticing. Less and less enticing. So that some beings just can't be seduced by Maya at all. At least by definition. Not that we can perceive. Returning to ignorance. Whoever is fixed in the ultimate goal of tat tvamasi, they go and they don't return to the foolishness of attachment to things of the world. They remain fixed in that goal of becoming of union with God. Knowledge endows one with humility. The learned perceive with equanimity one who knows wisdom, a cow, an elephant, a dog, or a man of low status. Even here, creation is conquered by them whose minds are established in equanimity. For supreme divinity allows no faults and is always the same, therefore they are established in supreme divinity. Neither will he rejoice upon obtaining that which is desirable, nor will he be perturbed upon obtaining the undesirable. Fixed in intelligence, unencumbered by foolishness, one who knows supreme divinity is established in supreme divinity. With his soul unattached to the contacts with the external, happiness is found in the soul itself. He has united his soul in the union with supreme divinity and enjoys infinite happiness. For those pleasures born from external contacts are certainly the womb of sorrows. O son of she who takes away the deficiency of others, Arjuna, the intelligent will not rejoice in that which has a beginning and an end. That man who is able to bear patiently the agitation born of desire and anger, even here, before being liberated from the body, he is in union, he is happy. Who has happiness within, who has tranquility within, who is in union with the light within, he alone is a man in union with the infinite supreme bliss, and attains to oneness with the supreme divinity. Having attained to oneness with the supreme divinity, the seers of divinity have destroyed their defects. Controlling their own selves, they cut through duality. They delight in the welfare of all beings. Those self-controlled beings who have controlled their consciousness are free from anger and desire. The soul established in wisdom on all sides in every way exists in oneness with the supreme divinity. Withdrawing context from all externals and fixing the gaze within, between the two eyebrows, making the incoming breath equal to the outflowing breath moving through the nostrils, controlling the senses, mind, and intellect, the goal of the wise is liberation. Without desire, fear, or anger, he alone is certainly free. By knowing me as the enjoyer of sacrifices and purifying austerities, and as the great supreme lord of all the worlds, as the friend of all existence, he attains peace. Oh. So now they're telling us, even though you're going to find the path of action is superior, now, with that knowledge, what action should you perform? Fix your gaze within between the eyebrows. Withdraw your senses inside. Make the incoming breath equal to the outflowing breath. Control your senses, mind, and intellect. And have liberation as the goal, which is supreme. All the actions that we perform are outside are only valuable so as they, insofar as they support our directing our attention inside. Because any enjoyment that we attain outside is transient. And it's only valuable for only a short moment, the swing of a club. Whereas when we look inside, we attain a greater delight, a greater enjoyment, which lasts. It comes with us wherever we go.
So what?
Yes, please, go ahead, Dave.
So he's saying, fixing the gaze within and making the breath equal, doing that in action?
Yes, that is an action. That is action.
So doing pranayama, and basically doing pranayama all the time.
All the time, and being aware of it.
Talking about sitting down in an asana
Did he say sit down?
No, he didn't. But when you're sitting in an asana and you're performing pranayama, you're still doing action.
Yes, you are.
Meditation is an action, so he wasn't describing that actual.
He was describing that actual, whether you were sitting still or standing up.
Or performing, like, golfing and doing pranayama at the same time.
The most successful golfer does pranayama and fixes his gaze inside at the same time.
How do you control your action, your senses, if you're playing golf?
You
watch
the ball. Keep your eye on the ball.
In a high level of concentration, doesn't pranayama just become spontaneous and natural?
But if you're practiced, then it becomes even more spontaneous and more natural. If you have a habit of performing pranayama, then it is even more efficient, so that when you focus and concentrate, your pranayama becomes more efficient. Most people don't know how to sit, and they have a habit of leaning over, and they breathe between the nostrils and the lungs. Those yogis who know to keep their backbone straight, they breathe from the nostrils to the abdomen. So their natural state of pranayama is different from somebody who's just slouching on the couch all the time. A couch potato. Om Sam Saraswati Namaha.
Yum, yum.
That was chapter 5. We could spend a week or two there. They're all good chapters. We had that in the first day of class. Somebody asked us about chapter 2, I think. And chapter 5 is a good chapter, too. Yes, it certainly does. And ultimately, a lot of interesting changes in our behaviors because of it. And that's what happens in satsang. I think we talked about that in the introduction to the Guru Gita. That a guru is someone who inspires new values and new thoughts and new goals and new paths. Because of sitting in satsang with the guru, suddenly we get inspired to new forms of behavior. And when we look around, we're new people with new friends and new associations, living in new places and doing different things than we were before we met the guru. And that's what happened to all of us. Each of us, as we move deeper and deeper into our relationship with the guru, we found that the old desires just weren't so important anymore. And maybe it's more important for us to contemplate the essence of the Gita than to be thinking about some frivolous or trivial entertainment. So we prefer to come to satsang and be with the guru and share in our communion with truth than to go out and pursue some personal desire. Om Sang Saraswati Namaha. Rishi, and there's Brahmarshi, and there's Maharishi, and
Brahmarishi ji Brahmo ke Brahmo gyan prapti hue.
Yes. Mother is describing a Brahmarshi as as a rishi of Brahmagyan. Yes, who has what I like to do is take ish to see or to perceive. And ra means again. Ra plus ish means rishi. Now ish means to perceive, Ishwar, who perceives all without limitation. And Ra plus Ish, he who again sees as Ishwar sees, is a Rishi. And Dev Rishi, who sees divinity or sees the gods as Ishwar sees is a Devarishi. And Maharishi is a great seer. And a Brahmarshi.
Today it came, you know, Brahmarishi, Shamanji. We should write down that book, Brahmarishi.
Excuse me, we're explaining the meaning. Brahma will be supreme divinity.
You explain them, I'm telling that.
I was overruled from the first day. What are you talking about? I'm still overruled. Brahma will be the supreme divinity. And Rishi, who sees again as Ishwar sees the supreme divinity, will be Brahmarshi.
See, as Brahma sees.
You take it. You make your inferences yourself. Who sees Brahman as Ishwar sees Brahman? The supreme divinity, the supreme consciousness, who perceives supreme consciousness as Ishwar sees supreme consciousness, will be Brahmarshi, Brahmarishi.
How do you know how Ishwar sees supreme?
There is no limit to how Ishwar sees. They call it Brahma consciousness, yes. And they call it Brahma Sadyuj. And they also call it Brahma Pooch. And we'll get that in chapter 13 or chapter
4.
Yes, in the consciousness of Brahman. Now, you can go on. I thought it was called Brahma Pooch, if I'm not...
I told you already. I'm going now. Thank you.
Well, see, that's what I said. You can go on.
Brahmarshi Sahib Sadhu.
Sahib is
Sahib. Sahib or Sahib? Sahib, huh?
Sahib or Sahib?
What did they give me? Sahib?
Sahib.
Brahmarshi Sahib Sadhu.
He's white.
Sahib means white. This is a stupid Sahib.
This is a stupid Sahib?
No. Why you need to give a Sahib name? Yeah? You human being have black and white, you know, you already know.
The black and white Sahib.
Good night, nice to see you guys.
Nice, Ma. No, thank you.